Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, we open our show with some very exciting news about a local East County company's innovation to help in the battle against the Zika virus, a growing epidemic worldwide. And then on Tribal Beat, Leon Thompson will tell you about the Viejas tribe's efforts to improve medical safety for people across our rural region. And we'll have some news about the Sequan tribe's successful efforts to slash water use on its reservation, including at its golf course and resort. We'll also have news about a freak plane crash onto a local freeway over the weekend that involved a Hamu pilot and claimed the life of a San Diego roller derby player, injuring several others. Then from Public News Service, we have a warning from the AARP about IRS tax phone scams targeting seniors this tax season. On the presidential campaign trail, Republican Donald Trump has made headlines by stating five different positions on abortion in the last few days, at one point saying women who have abortions should be punished with potentially criminal sanctions. Today we'll show you how women who seek or obtain abortions are already being punished across the United States with new laws, primarily in Republican-controlled states that restrict access to abortion, in some cases putting women's lives and health at risk, as well as prolonging the pain and suffering of babies with severe birth defects, and will tell you just what's at stake for women in this election. We'll also have information from Public News Service about why teachers' unions in California are celebrating a recent Supreme Court ruling. And then on the second half of today's show, our newsmaker interview is with Lemon Grove's Mayor Pro Tem George Gastel. He'll be talking about some upcoming plans for Lemon Grove, as well as transportation issues in our region. We'll also have details on a History Alive program coming up from the Lemon Grove Historical Society this week on how San Diego almost became a Russian-controlled community. Then on Sounds of History, we'll replay our interview by Helen Oldfield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society with Dick Pennock of the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum, sharing some colorful stories that train lovers won't want to miss about the history of the railway in our region. We'll also have an update on the county's temporary shutdown of Covert Canyon's military and law enforcement live fire training in Alpine. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with an exciting health update right here in East County. A Spring Valley company, CalBiotech Inc., has just announced that it has come out with the United States' first immunoassay kits to detect antibodies against Zika virus in human blood. The Zika virus was first isolated back in 1947 in a rhesus monkey during a yellow fever study in Uganda's Zika forest. The virus has since spread via the yellow fever mosquito to tropical and subtropical regions around the world. Officials estimate up to 1.5 million people have contracted Zika virus in Brazil alone. And as of March, Zika has spread to over 40 countries, including 273 cases in the U.S., David Barca, the vice president of CalBiotech, says, "I am proud of our team's collaborative effort to work quickly and diligently to develop this very important diagnostic tool that will aid doctors and researchers in their efforts to control this outbreak. Zika virus infection causes no symptoms in many patients, making it very difficult to get an early diagnosis. When illness does occur, the symptoms are usually mild, with rash, fever, conjunctivitis, or joint pain. Only 20% of people infected show any of those symptoms, which can last a few days to a week after they're stung by an infected mosquito. But recent studies indicate Zika virus can cause abnormal development in fetuses, resulting in miscarriage or babies born with severe microcephaly, a serious condition in which the baby's head and brain are severely underdeveloped. Due to the potential link between Zika virus infection and microcephaly, the World Health Organization in February declared a public health emergency of international concern." Here in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control conclude there are multiple cases of Zika virus being transmitted from person to person now, typically through sexual contact or from mother to child during pregnancy or birth, not just mosquitoes. Both these scenarios emphasize the importance of an accurate diagnostic. CalBiotech Scientific Director Jonas Johannes observes, the Summer Olympics in Brazil, combined with the upcoming mosquito season, may accelerate the spread of Zika virus to a global scale. As the disease spreads, more efficient diagnostics will be needed. Now, the company is working on developing additional ways to advance critical diagnostics. CalBiotech's Zika virus kits can determine if a patient is infected using only 10 microliters of serum or plasma, delivering results in less than an hour. CalBiotech is in the application phase now for an emergency use authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and is currently offering these products for research use only. CalBiotech is collaborating, however, with partners and government agencies in the U.S. and Brazil to aid in the implementation of these tests. And in addition, CalBiotech is developing a Zika virus diagnostic based on its proprietary magnetic bead platform, which aims to offer enhanced sensitivity to help diagnose and ultimately stem spread of the Zika virus. For more information on this exciting discovery, you can visit calbiotech.com.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. There's a new medical helicopter now serving East County. The Viejas Fire Department and California Reach will be holding a ribbon-cutting ceremony on Friday, April 8th, to unveil the new helicopter based at the Viejas Reservation in Alpine. The new helicopter will serve communities across rural East County. Reach now has 5 medically equipped helicopters and 1 airplane in Southern California to transport patients to needed care. Reach was named Program of the Year by the Association of Air Medical Services for exceeding industry standards for patient care and safety. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
The Sequan tribe in El Cajon is doing its part to save water through an aggressive conservation program that includes retrofitting irrigation equipment, replacing water-dependent landscaping, and increasing awareness around the importance of water conservation. The program has reduced the tribe's reliance on groundwater at the golf course and resort by 25% and cut water use on properties within the Padre Dam and Otay Municipal Water Districts by an average of 22%. Sequan Chairman Cody Martinez states Sequan is committed to doing its part to conserve, reduce, and reuse water through the reservation and our commercial enterprises. We are proud of the reductions we have achieved so far and intend to increase our efforts this year and beyond, he adds. Projects on the original reservation completed to date include removal of over 25,000 square feet of turf and replacement with drought-tolerant xeriscape landscaping or mulch, replacement of over 5,000 sprinkler nozzles, and replacing 35 irrigation clocks with smart clocks that self-adjust to real-time weather. Sequan also doubled lands irrigated with reclaimed water and converted high water usage irrigation systems to drip, increasing its efficiency from 40 to 90% in those areas. The installation of xeriscape landscaping further resulted in over a 50% reduction of water use in those properties. The tribe plans to undertake additional projects that will build on work already performed, including more turf removal, connecting acreage of the original reservation to newly installed purple pipes in some areas, installing a state-of-the-art reverse osmosis system to further benefit the groundwater well field, and expanding its water reclamation plant. The Native American tribe's work has been recognized by the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, which has provided over $65,000 in rebates to support this water conservation program. The original Sequan Reservation is entirely dependent on groundwater, with newer portions of the reservation served by the Padre Dam and Otay Municipal Water Districts. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson. A local roller derby player is dead after the car in which she was a passenger was struck by a small plane that crash-landed on Interstate 15 in Fallbrook Saturday morning. 3 other local roller derby players were also injured along with the airplane's pilot and its passenger. The Landcare 4 airplane was piloted by Hamul resident Dennis Hogue, who has been hospitalized with life-threatening injuries, including head trauma, 10 News reports. The plane struck a car parked on the freeway shoulder. Inside were 4 San Diego roller derby members. Antoinette Toni Frances Isabel of San Diego, known as Rockalicious on the Starlets roller derby team, was crushed in the back seat and died at the scene, the Union Tribune reports. The car's driver, Aaron McCann of Escondido, suffered a cut over his eye. He is known as Roadway Roadbuster in the Aftershock roller derby group. Passengers Jason Sewell, also known as Vanilla Gorilla on the Aftershocks team, reportedly had a broken shoulder. Emily Bozmiller Hotch had a leg injury. Both are from San Diego. A female passenger in the plane suffered a large laceration on her neck and later underwent surgery, the UT reports. Some witnesses reported hearing a sputtering sound before the plane came down, skidding about 250 feet before the collision. Several witnesses rushed to help free victims from the wreckage. Firefighters soon arrived and prevented the vehicle from catching fire, doubtless saving more lives.
California has seen a huge surge in reports of threatening or aggressive phone scams in this income tax filing season, according to experts with AARP's FraudWatch network. This year, the group is warning of several types of scams. In one version, a person will call and pretend to be from the Internal Revenue Service and will sometimes begin to bully the consumer, demanding payment. Amy Nofziger with the AARP Fraud Watch Network says the IRS will never call without having contacted the taxpayer first by mail and will never threaten to involve the police, arrest you, or deport you.
The IRS will never require that you use a specific payment method, such as a prepaid debit card, wire transfer, money order. We've even heard of scammers asking for people to go and get gift cards.
She says identity theft tends to spike this time of year when scammers use a person's stolen birth date and social security number to try and intercept their income tax refund. Nofziger advises people to use a locked mailbox and never leave outgoing mail that contains personal information on it in the mailbox. Instead, take it directly to the post office. And beware what you leave in your trash can.
Always shred your personal and private information and use a confetti shredder, because there are people that have a lot of time on their hands that will sit there and put those pieces of paper back together.
If you need help filing your taxes, AARP's free tax aid program helped more than 187,000 people file their income tax returns last year. Get more information or find a tax aid location on the AARP.org website. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Media headlines have been filled the last few days with news about Donald Trump's changing stance on abortion. The Washington Post reports that Trump took five different stances in 3 days after stating on MSNBC that he believed there should be punishment for women who have abortions, but not for the men who impregnate them. Though Trump later shifted his stance following stinging criticisms, the truth is that in many Republican-controlled states, women who seek abortions or obtain them are already being punished with laws that restrict access, even in extreme cases, such as to end a miscarriage in progress or help a mother prevent carrying to term a fetus so severely damaged that it cannot survive or would face a brief life filled with suffering and pain. After suggesting that women who get abortions should face criminal punishment, Trump quickly changed his position to say doctors who perform abortions should be punished, but not women. In the past, he has shifted from pro-choice to pro-life. And then last week, he said he believes laws should, quote, stay the same, unquote, but only until he is president and can appoint judges who would restrict abortion, presumably including Supreme Court justices who could overturn Roe v. Wade, making abortion again illegal nationwide. Trump's main Republican opponent, Ted Cruz, has said he wants to ban abortion even in cases of rape or incest, making him even more extreme, arguably, than Trump. Since Trump has said he is pro-life but with exceptions, but hasn't spelled out just what those exceptions would be. Both Democratic contenders Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have staunchly defended a woman's right to choose, but that right is increasingly being restricted in many states. Across America, more and more women are already being punished for having or seeking abortions due to restrictive laws imposed there. The most extreme measures are in red, Republican-controlled states, although even some blue states have adopted limited restrictions pushed by conservative voters and legislators. Women in the U.S. are currently already in jail for choosing abortion or even helping family members obtain one, Time magazine reveals. A Pennsylvania mother, Jennifer Whalen, was jailed for giving her teenage daughter a drug to induce abortion in the very early weeks of pregnancy. Other women have been jailed for using medications or other methods to self-induce abortion. If Republicans who want to outlaw abortion even for rape victims victims have their way, the U.S. could wind up like some countries in South America and Africa, where rape survivors are jailed for choosing not to give birth to their rapists' babies. Mothers in some Central American countries are being forced to give birth to Zika babies whose brains have liquefied because abortion is illegal there. And if some conservatives have their way, this could soon happen to women in the U.S. who contract Zika while pregnant through a mosquito bite or from a sexual partner who transmits Zika. Extreme pro-life stances go far beyond protecting the lives of healthy babies, and some laws actually prolong the suffering of both mothers in physical pain as well as fetuses so severely deformed that if born, they are forced to endure painful surgeries and still ultimately die after a brief but pain-filled life. Here's some examples. A new Texas law forces women who have partially miscarried to wait and have their babies die in the womb, Yahoo News reports. Taylor Mahaffey began to miscarry shortly after 20 weeks into her pregnancy. Her husband wrote online that the feet were already coming out of the womb and pushing through the cervix when they reached the hospital, but due to a Texas law that prohibits inducing labor after 20 weeks, the hospital sent her home to suffer. Mahaffey felt the unborn child struggle inside her for days and was in such pain that she was left screaming, said her husband, who called the law cruel, inhumane, and morally indefensible. Such laws also put a woman at risk of developing sepsis, an infection that can kill her. Indiana just passed a law that prohibits doctors from advising women about abortion options, even with a fetal anomaly so severe that it can lead to significant lifelong disability or death of a baby. Physician Catherine McHugh, writing in the Chicago Tribune, voiced horror over the law. "I have cried with families as we watched their babies breathe their last breath," she writes, seeking to spare mothers such pain when death from deformities is inevitable. The doctor describes some conditions where abortion would be the more compassionate option, in her opinion. These include Patau syndrome that can leave babies with no nose or one eye, defective kidneys, and a spinal cord without any skin covering it. Most of these are stillborn, mercifully, and of the few that aren't, 80% die in the first year, and the rest require intensive spinal and cardiac surgeries, among other painful procedures. Another condition, spinal muscular atrophy, such as Wernicke-Hoffmann disease, causes fast neurologic degeneration, so the baby dies of respiratory or breathing failure within a year. If such pregnancies cannot be terminated, the doctor asks, should prenatal screening tests even be offered? If you want to see examples of these sorts of things, just Google birth deformities, and warning, you'll find some very graphic and disturbing images. There is also the impact on families to consider. Currently, 60-90% of women terminate pregnancies when Down syndrome is diagnosed, which causes mental retardation. But tests to diagnose it cannot be done until after the deadline that many states impose, forcing women to either go out of state for abortion or give birth to a child that will require a lifetime of special care. Other conditions require even more costly care if a child cannot walk or breathe on its own, requires intensive therapy, surgeries, home nursing care, and frequent hospitalizations, for example. Conjoined twins may be inseparable, if joined at the head or chest, for example. Severe deformities can require care that could bankrupt most families. What's a mother to do who cannot afford such high costs, which are staggering even with insurance that only partially covers those expenses? The child may not even get the care that's needed, or the family may have to sacrifice needs of other children, such as forgoing paying for their college. Such laws are no longer rare. Since 1973, when the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision legalized abortion in most cases, states have adopted hundreds of laws to restrict a woman's option to choose abortion. According to Guttmacher.org, which tracks abortion laws, as of March 1st of this year, 43 states ban abortion except to protect the mother's life or health after a certain point in the pregnancy, usually viability. Since many serious fetal conditions cannot be diagnosed until after that point, these laws force women to give birth to severely impaired babies or break the law to end their pregnancies. 38 states require abortions be performed by a doctor, and 18 require that they be done in a hospital after the earliest stages. This has resulted in closure of many abortion clinics, forcing women in states like Texas to drive up to 500 miles to obtain abortion and often delaying the procedure until late in pregnancy. 28 states impose waiting periods, usually 24 hours, after a woman requests an abortion until she can actually have the procedure, sometimes forcing overnight stays if the abortion clinic or provider is far from her home. Most states require parental notification if a minor seeks abortion, and 25 of them require at least one parent to consent. If a parent refuses, a teen, however young, is forced to give birth, even if it's incest, even if doing so is physically dangerous to girls as young as 10 or 11 who are pregnant. 45 states allow health care providers to refuse to participate in abortions, and 42 let institutions refuse to perform them, further limiting women's options. Only 17 states allow public funding even for medically necessary abortions, such as saving women's lives. 11 states even prohibit private insurance plans from covering abortion, or they limit abortion coverage to cases where the woman could die without the procedure. Some require women who want abortion coverage to purchase it separately. Religious conservatives, such as Congressman Duncan Hunter, want to declare that life begins at conception, even before a fertilized egg implants in the womb. Never mind that about half of those fertilized eggs never do implant, or that some implant in the fallopian tubes, about 1 in 100, where without abortion the tube explodes and the mother can die or be left sterile, and there's no baby to save in such cases since there's no room in a fallopian tube for it to grow to viability. So only the life of the mother can be saved. And yet, life begins at conception laws would doom these mothers potentially to death and also prevent some forms of birth control, such as intrauterine devices or IUDs. They would also ban the morning after pill. A brand new Arizona law defies new federal guidelines on pills that can induce abortion. Illogically, Arizona now requires the drugs be administered at higher doses than the federal guidelines, an action that can cause unnecessary pain, cramping, and health risks to women. And yet another new state law mandates anesthesia for women seeking abortion beyond the earliest weeks, even if she has a condition that could make being anesthetized dangerous. The law is well-intentioned, seeking to prevent fetal pain, but it fails to take into account the health of the mother. Ironically, many of the same religious zealots who seek to protect lives of babies without protecting lives, health, or choice of mothers and families are also pushing forth other laws that restrict women's rights to contraception or even unbiased information that could help them prevent getting pregnant. A growing number of red states no longer have sex education in public schools that include information on birth control. Instead, they teach abstinence only. Teen pregnancies have soared in those states, unlike in Europe, where teen pregnancies have fallen after scientifically based sex education programs were made mandatory in public schools. Are these laws truly pro-life, or is there a broader war on women in the GOP, as has often been asserted by some? The list of new restrictive laws targeting women goes on and on. Some seek to allow employers to deny coverage for birth control to women employees. Another, Mississippi House Bill 1523, that's just gone to their governor for signature, would allow businesses, individuals, and religious organizations, including hospitals, schools, and homeless shelters, among others, to discriminate against single women or women who have sex outside of marriage, as well as against gay or transgender people. So a single mother could be denied food at a food pantry for her children or daycare at a nursery. A landlord could refuse to rent to a woman having premarital sex. A school could expel a teen student found to be unchaste. What's next? Branding women with scarlet letters if they don't meet the standards of a particular religious group? Ironically, many of these same Christian fundamentalists who want to impose laws to restrict women's rights to choose when to have sex, restrict her access to birth control, abortion, and information on these health issues, are also quick to voice fears over Muslim fundamentalists who advocate Sharia law that forces women to cover their faces and bodies, be subject to the dictates of men, and punished or even stoned to death in some countries if they are victimized by rape. But to those who may not share the most extreme religious views of either Muslims or Christian fundamentalists or any other group, the results of imposing religious views into laws that restrict women's freedom to make choices about their own health care and lives can be equally disturbing. What if you, your daughter, or your sister discovered she was carrying a fetus so deformed it could not possibly have a normal life, not filled with pain and suffering? What if her life was at risk, or she were raped, or, heaven forbid, a victim of incest? Or she has cancer and needs chemotherapy to save her life, which can't be done if she's pregnant. The Supreme Court is just one vote away from making abortion illegal in the U.S., in many or perhaps all cases. With Republicans currently in control of Congress, a win by Donald Trump or Ted Cruz could mean not even waiting for the Supreme Court to act. Congress and the president could sweep through restrictive new laws immediately. Elections have consequences, and the consequences for women have never been greater than in the choices voters will cast in this year's presidential and congressional elections. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Public education unions are celebrating after the U.S. Supreme Court's 4-4 split decision on Tuesday. It allows a lower court ruling to stand that says it is constitutional for unions to charge a mandatory agency fee to cover services that also benefit non-members. Before the recent death of Justice Antonin Scalia, unions were concerned the decision could go the other way, depriving them of a major source of funding. Science teacher Kimberly Clater, who is president of the Newport Mesa Federation of Teachers in Orange County, applauds the outcome.
The fees are fair because there is no free lunch. People should not benefit for something that other people pay for. This is work that members and non-members benefit from, so it's just a fair share.
The case, Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, was brought by a group of non-union teachers who objected to the fee recruited by the Libertarian Center for Individual Rights. Clater says much of public employees' unions' work, such as negotiating contracts and lobbying for stable education funding, affects workers no matter their union membership preferences. She notes that labor unions have long fought for the little guy, promoting such policies as the Affordable Care Act and California's newly announced plans for a $15 state minimum wage.
We're the biggest threat to organized money, shall we say. So there's all kinds of different policies that we fight for that are not necessarily just benefiting our members. They benefit the 99%.
There are several similar cases challenging agency fees still making their way to the Supreme Court. And with the current court split down the middle, the next high court justice will likely be the deciding vote in future cases. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is East County Magazine, and I'm Leon Thompson. Our special guest today is George Gassel, and we're going to be talking about Lemon Grove. George has been a member of the Lemon Grove City Council since 2008, and before that, he served on the Lemon Grove School Board for 10 years. George is presently the mayor pro tem in rotation this year, graduate of Grossmont High School and on the board of the MTS. Welcome to our studios.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us what's going on in Lemon Grove.
Well, Lemon Grove's coming out of the recession. It's very exciting to see our city doing well. I don't know if people realize during the recession, we lost about one third of our employees. And we actually did an amazing job of holding the city together, despite the fact that sales tax was way, way down and property tax was down. And we're coming out of the recession very well, much happier, healthier community. We're looking forward to making our city more beautiful and expanding sidewalks and working on a couple projects that we hope we'll see come to fruition in the next few years. The most exciting thing is that we're working on what we call a linear park that would go from the north side of the city to the south side following the trolley line on Main Street. We call it Connect Main Street. And that's gonna take several years, and we're going to have to get some funding that we don't yet have, but we're taking it on with the attitude that if you plan it and you have the right plan at the right time, you can find the money for these things. We're also have in the works a plan to have the freeway entrance from Broadway go to the freeway from Broadway without having to cross the trolley tracks and then cross them again. And that would save not only time, but it would also save a lot of exhaust in the middle of our city, because near Broadway and Lemon Grove Avenue, it takes a while to get onto the freeway, and it's not good for anybody.
Yes, there is a little hitch there in the traffic when you get right off, right there by the freeway. You have to cross the railroad tracks.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're crossing railroad tracks twice, that should give you the idea that you might not need to cross them at all.
Exactly. Is a linear park. Tell us about it.
Connect Main Street. That's the idea of a park that would follow Main Street right next to the trolley tracks.
Lemon Grove has two trolley stations?
Yeah, we're very fortunate. A city of 25,000 with two trolley stations. I don't know if there's another city our size that has two trolley stations in California. That's really something. And
so that means that a lot of people are within walking distance of the trolley. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. A large percentage of Lemon Grove is in walking distance of the trolley. We benefit from having two trolley stations, and we want to make sure that people can walk to the trolley stations. That's one of the reasons why, obviously, Connect Main Street is going to help and make it much more attractive. We also need to get more paths, more walkable space in other parts of the city so that people can come from many different directions.
What about bike lanes?
We have bike lanes on Lemon Grove Avenue. I think they look really neat. They're cool and green.
Oh.
Yeah. Some people don't like the neon green, but I do. I think it's nice. I think it really shows up. We could use more bike lanes. We need more spaces that people can walk. One thing we noticed is that sidewalks are great, and we do need more sidewalks in lots of places, but we noticed that there are areas where you could walk if there weren't cars parked there. So that's, in some areas, that's something we're going to be working on, is to find some space where people can walk without having to walk around parked cars.
That would be nice.
Yeah, it would be really.
So the walkability factor in Lemon Grove, the multimodal transporting idea is, it sounds to me like Lemon Grove is kind of ripe for that, with two trolley stations and a park right down through the middle of the town.
And in a city of 25,000 that's only 4 square miles, it is ripe for, it should be much more walkable. And I think in the next 8 years, you'll see a difference. Yeah, I think and related to that is encouraging people to walk, because a lot of it is the mindset. We've actually made great strides in this area in recent times. The school district has promoted walking to school, and the city, working together with the school district, has gotten money from what's called Safe Routes to School and made some really noticeable improvements. So I think if you live in Lemon Grove in the past 8 years or so, you see improvements from several of the schools and how people get there. And want to keep going on, keep working on that. A while back, one of the council members and I did an activity. The school district encourages this, an activity pretty frequently, where they have people walk, and they invited council members to walk to school with the kids. And I got to see some of the issues that are involved in the Monterey Heights area getting to school, which actually is one of the better ones. Everywhere we can, we're fixing all the issues that would discourage people from walking or that would compromise people's safety if they walk to school. But I think it's part of a big effort to make more safe routes, not just to school, but all around the city.
Yes.
And then eventually I want to see all these routes connected to each other. So,
yes.
So that people can go many different directions. And then the other exciting thing that we're talking about more and more is more interesting destinations.
Mm.
Where are you walking to?
Mm-hmm.
And that leads us, for example, to the issue of restaurants and the fact that we don't have enough diversity of restaurants, and we don't have enough interesting restaurants.
Really?
Yeah. And also the issue of recreation. Could have more recreational activities that people want to do. But we have made progress. I mean, here's an example of the progress we've made in recent times. We now have a library in the middle of town.
Mm.
You remember?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
It used to be accessible to people in the Catholic Church. And people in a few areas in the eastern side of town. Now it's in the middle of town. It's much more visible. You can actually see it from the trolley. And the library is getting a lot more use. It's definitely much more center of the community than it was before. The city played only a small role in that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important that we keep up. You know, we played a cooperative role in helping it happen. It's important that we keep building on these connections,
mm-hmm.
and that we try to have a rec center and a library and a school district and all these other things that need to be working together.
You know, Lemon Grove's gone through some changes. Mary Sessom, who was the longtime mayor, 20 years as a mayor?
She was 20 years as mayor, and before that, 2 years as a city council member.
And she's moving on. She's retiring, and you have a new city manager.
Mm-hmm. Lydia Romero is our new city manager. She used to be the assistant city manager in San Marcos.
I see. Oh, so she moved down here from North County. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let me say a little bit about Mary Sessom, because she's a really dear person to many of us. She is the longest serving mayor in the county at this point in history.
Mm.
And I believe she's had that status ever since Art Madrid left office. Mary has really been terrific. I mean, she's probably had more influence on the city than any other individual in the past generation. And we were very fortunate to have a city manager, Graham Mitchell, who stayed with us for quite a long time. He was an excellent city manager. Between the two of them, I think we've seen an awful lot of progress and an awful lot that we might be taking for granted in our city. For example, Home Depot is a huge asset to our city. The promenade that we have won an award, quite a beautiful promenade, and moving the H. Lee House and setting up if you look at where the Historical Society is now, it's at Civic Center Park,
mm-hmm.
and that whole complex, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, this stuff just doesn't build itself.
Right.
These things don't happen by accident.
Right.
The library, even though the city didn't build the library, the city has played a cooperative role in making it happen.
Right.
And during the 20 years that she was mayor, we've not only seen a lot of improvements in our city, but we've also seen Lemon Grove take a major role in regional government. She has served, continues to serve on the Airport Authority. She's served on SANDAG, I believe, for the San Diego Association of Governments, I should say.
Right.
For the entire time that she's been mayor, I believe. And Lemon Grove is known as a regional leader. For a city of 25,000, we have quite a lot of impact.
Yes, you do. And yourself, you're on the board of the Metropolitan Transit.
MTS, Metropolitan Transit System.
Yes.
Right.
And right. So yours as mm-hmm. well. And what are some of the things we can expect from MTS? If I might divert to that for just a second, can you tell us about what's coming up on the MTS?
Oh, yeah. Well, MTS is exciting. When I ran for city council, I didn't know that I would be doing so much with trains. The only clue I had was that on my third birthday, I did in fact have a train on my cake. And so, I look back on, that's actually one of my first memories, and I should have known, I should have seen it, you know, that trains would be part of my life in ways that I hadn't even expected. But I'm not only on the board of MTS, I'm also on the board of the Los Angeles, San Diego, San Luis Obispo Rail Corridor Agency, which is
how'd you end up on that?
Better known as LOSAN. I'm the MTS representative.
Oh, okay.
LOSAN. The good people in MTS asked if I could represent them on this body, which deals with Metrolink and the Surfliner and basically trains that connect a large part of Southern California. That's very, very exciting. And I'm also on the board of Facilitating Access to Coordinated Transportation, which is a nonprofit that's funded heavily by SANDAG that provides transportation to elderly and disabled people. So, yeah, so transportation has really been my thing. I think in the near future, I think we are going to see improvements in the Compass Card.
Uh-huh.
That's what everybody asks about that. We haven't had a public meeting, so it's hard for me to speak to this very much, but I can say that we're expecting to make quite a few improvements in the Compass Card. And one thing that people might look at is some other cities, particularly Portland. Portland is the best known city probably in the West Coast for its public transportation and quite a leader in regional government as well as public transportation. We're actually watching cities like Portland to see the systems that they have and we want to see the bugs that they,
right.
you know, we want to see the, how it
from
works for them.
Mistakes and successes.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So the Compass Card is a tap and go, right?
Mm-hmm.
At this point, now, can you do value added where you add to your card?
I believe you can.
Okay.
You know, one wonderful thing that MTS does is they give their board members passes so that we can drive the trolley. Mm,
yes.
As much as we want. And I'm an avid trolley rider, very regular trolley rider ever since I got on the board of MTS. But But the downside, I was going to say the mistake they made was they made it too easy for us.
Really?
Yeah, because they just gave us passes that are indefinite, unlimited. And so I haven't actually used a compass card.
Well, $5 is a day pass, and that means take the trolley anywhere you want all day long.
Oh, what a deal. I've certainly gotten an awful lot of emails, but I think sometimes people lose perspective and they don't realize how many things we might be taking for granted. The last time MTS talked about the compass card, we were talking about security concerns. It was not a public meeting. We do much better than most major city guards.
That's interesting. Yeah. You know, I go to the ball games, mm-hmm. you know, on the trolley from Santee, and hey, anybody who thinks of it as something like, you know, the subways of New York with gangs and problems, it's not like that. The little red car is a very cool place to be.
Yeah, I like the trolley a lot. I've ridden subways in New York, and Mexico City is actually my favorite subway.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, they stop about every minute or so. I mean, it's, you know, and you can't act in Mexico City. Not everybody gets on the subway when it stops. It's like they get on as many as can, and then the rest of them wait for the next one. It's kind of how it works. Yeah, very limited time, and as many as possible get on, and you just. But the next one comes really, really soon. So
yeah.
It's an interesting system, and you can go anywhere in Mexico City for like almost nothing. It's just so ridiculously cheap to go absolutely anywhere in Mexico City, as I recall. Yeah. Well, you know, we're far from that, but I think we do pretty well. And I'm really excited that the trolley's going to, in the near future, is going to be going to UCSD.
UCSD, right. Mm-hmm. It already stops at San Diego State Underground, a beautiful station there.
Well, I use that a lot. I teach at San Diego State. Yeah. Right. I know that station very well.
Yeah, it's really nice. Come up right in the middle of the campus practically and,
Yeah, the people at San Diego State are very, 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 very proud to have that.
It's been a real pleasure having you with us, George.
Thank you.
And come again.
Oh, thank you.
The Lemon Grove Historical Society invites the public to hear a provocative History Alive presentation by Jack Innes of San Diego Legends. He'll be speaking on April 7th at 7 o'clock in the evening in the Historical Society's headquarters at the H. Lee House in Lemon Grove. The topic will be the time long ago when San Diego nearly became a Russian city. That's right, says Historical Society President Helen Ofield. If the fates had prevailed, sushi, fish tacos, and craft beer would be history in this town. Instead, vodka, borscht, and anything made with potatoes would be standard fare here instead. On the plus side, Bellini and caviar would probably abound, provided you were in the Kremlin inner circle. Jack Innes, the last word in stories of the strange, hilarious, and true, will be filling you in on this little-known aspect of San Diego's past, and he'll be bringing the latest edition of San Diego Legends to this fascinating History Alive program. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. Today, we are resuming our conversation with Richard Penick, the former president and CEO, founding member, and now the media coordinator of the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Association. Dick Penick, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, good morning, Helen. I'm glad to be here again with you. It's certainly my pleasure.
Last time, we learned about the size and operations of the Railway Museum. Our listeners can actually Google Pacific Southwest Railway, some variation of those words, and find you. But what's the main phone number?
The main phone number is area code 619-465-PSRM. That's 7776 on the dial.
I'm going to repeat that. It's 619-465-7776. Gosh, that's patriotic.
It is.
Sounds like the American Revolution. And it sounds like it was all the way out in Campo. You really have written the book on how to restore old trains and make them accessible to the public. Now, perhaps your most famous operation is that living history component, those weekend train rides at Campo. You are there as a conductor and locomotive engineer in full regalia, I might add. How much is a ticket, and do you still travel from Campo to Tecate?
We have weekend-only trains. We recommend that people check our website, psrm.org, to make sure of the schedule before they make the drive out there. It is a long way from San Diego, but certainly we feel it's worth the ride. We do not currently go to Tecate, and the reason is there is a railroad tunnel just over the international border on the Mexican side that burned and collapsed Christmas Day 2009. And since that time, the tunnel has not been repaired, and our monthly trips to Tecate had to be temporarily curtailed. So currently, we confine all of our operations and our special activities to the U.S. side of the border, between the border and Campo.
Why is the Campo train ride sometimes called the Polar Express?
Well, like all nonprofits, we do need to protect our bottom line, and we have many public activities, special activities during the year, the biggest one being our Santa train in the Christmas season. The first train runs the day after Thanksgiving, and we run 12 to 15 of those on consecutive weekends through the Christmas season. It is extremely popular, sold out every year, and as a matter of fact, Helen, members can buy their tickets for it right now.
Wonderful. Parents out there, get ready. Richard, at the dawn of the railroad, nobody had a union. There were no OSHA rules, occupational safety and health. So what were some of the dangers to, say, a brakeman on the railroad or another worker?
Interesting you ask about the brakeman, because on the railroad, particularly in the early days, that was one of the most dangerous occupations in train service. Now, even then, as now, you could get a job on the railroad in the office and never have to worry about ice and snow and sleet and storm. But the brakeman's job, before the days of air brakes, required that the brakeman, and they were all men in those days, had to ride the tops of the freight cars on a freight train in all weather, and they lost many of them in service, so there was generally always a job available, a job opening for brakemen, because the turnover was pretty high. It was a very hazardous occupation. Now, the passenger brakeman had it a little easier. He rode inside the passenger coaches, normally with a conductor, so that wasn't quite so bad. But the freight brakeman on the freight trains, pretty horrible job.
Now, when people were riding the rails, which is the subject of poetry and song and folk music and all of the lore of the 1930s, really, what was that like for somebody to ride the rails? Where are you?
You mean like a hobo?
Yes.
Well,
In a word.
There were two different types of illegal rail riders, hobos and bums. Bums in those days had the same connotation it has today. Hobos sometimes were of a different cut. Sometimes they were riding the train illegally, but sort of looked the other way officially, because they were searching for work. They were moving from one workplace, one seasonal workplace possibly, to another, and many of the railroads often cut them a little slack and would not necessarily kick them off. They were all lumped under the term hobo, but there were differences. The bums often spent their evenings in jail when they were caught, whereas the hobos were, if you can say, maybe a somewhat higher echelon of itinerant society, shall we say.
Dick, the classic movie image is of a group of hobos. These are lonely guys in felt hats who go and offer to chop wood for a sandwich. They're all together in an empty freight car. They jump off at different points. Are we saying the wino, some poor tragic guy, is literally under that freight car? If we're riding the rails, we're so close to the rails, we're almost on them. Is that what that phrase means? It's a scary thing.
Well, not necessarily, but certainly there have been a lot of fatalities by bums, winos, others that aren't supposed to be on the property, going to sleep in a drunken stupor on a railroad track, which can be a very fatal exercise. And it happens often on the Mexican side of the border, particularly at night. It even happens on the U.S. side. It's an unfortunate part of railroad operation. There are people that don't watch the crossing signs when they're crossing railroad tracks in their car or on foot, And in spite of all the warning signs and all of the measures the railroads try to take to promote safety, there
we
are still
tragedies even now.
Still tragedies.
Exactly. Richard, you have been intimately involved with railroads for all of your life, long ago and far away, as a carefree, wind-in-your-hair young man. Didn't you ride the rails? Have you had personal experience?
I did, and I do. Even in my senior years, I continue to have experiences that I cherish very highly. I will tell you that I have never had professional railroad experience. I get asked that question a lot. But I did try to get a job with the railroad in Oakland, California, back in the mid-1950s, right after I got out of high school, because I wanted to become a fireman on a steam locomotive. And unfortunately, the railroad was getting rid of its steam locomotives at the time, and they wrote me back a Dear John letter saying, well, we're sorry, but we've laid off most of our firemen because we don't have a need for them anymore. And I always look back on those days and wonder if, should I have continued with trying to get a railroad career.
Were you hand-firing a coal-burning?
No, that was on an oil-burning locomotive. It would have been had I got the job. But I had that opportunity many years later when we founded the museum. But you asked about some other adventures that I have had over the years, and those have been many, particularly with regard to trains. And I had one, and I have to tell you up front, Helen, that this was strictly illegal. Do not encourage anybody to do this. It is strictly forbidden and against the law. But I was young, headstrong, adventurous kid in those days, and I and others decided to hop a freight train on the railroad that we currently operate on, and we were going to take this ride through Carrizo Gorge and just have a ball. So we encamped ourselves on a flat car in a freight train, and we were coming back from El Centro in late afternoon, and there are 17 tunnels just in the 11 miles of the Carrizo Gorge section, and the first tunnel is protected by an overhead structure called a telltale. Basically, it's just a wooden framework with ropes with knots on the end of them hanging down about 3 feet below the top of this gantry. And it's designed to warn a trainman on top of a car that there's a tunnel or limited head clearance coming up. So should they be facing the wrong way, it warns them that you better duck because there's something coming up that might take the upper part of your torso off. So I was facing the wrong way when we were coming up to the first tunnel and enjoying the view and the fresh air in my hair. And all of a sudden, this telltale hit me in the back, and I immediately flattened on top of the car. And had I not done so, the tunnel was coming up in about an eighth of a mile, and I would have been a dead person. So it was
Richard,
very hazardous.
Thank you for sharing that. And dear listeners, this does fall under the heading of don't try this at home, unless you are the body double for Sean Connery. I think we've all seen somebody or Steve McQueen fall to the roof and suddenly there's a tunnel and the audience is aghast. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Helen.
Dick Pennick, this has been a wonderful conversation. I want to thank you for stopping by and sharing the lore, some of the lore. There's obviously much more from the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. We didn't even get into the archives, and I know you have a big, big archive of precious material. Thank you, listeners, for tuning into the Sounds of History. I'm Helen O'Field.
Spring is a beautiful time to hit the trail and bring your dog along. The good news is that dogs are allowed at all county parks except Agua Caliente and Wilderness Gardens Preserve. Assistants or guide dogs are always welcome at all parks as long as they are in compliance with the regulations and check in with the park staff. Here are some tips to make your hike enjoyable and safe for both you and your dog. First, plan out your hike. Know your dog's fitness level so you can match that with the length of trail and type of terrain you choose. You can check out trails online at the County Parks and Recreation Department. Second, be sure your dog is up to date on vaccines and have a collar or been treated to prevent ticks and fleas. Also, make sure your four-legged friend has current ID tags and a well-fitted collar in case you get separated. If your dog does become lost, contact the County of San Diego Department of Animal Services. Make sure the time of day you choose to hike with your dog is appropriate, avoiding hot temperatures
Unless you hike with your dog often and they are used to this type of rigorous exercise, they could succumb to heat exhaustion. Dogs are more susceptible to heat stroke than humans. Also, if the ground is too hot for your hand, it's too hot for your dog's paws. Always have plenty of water for both you and your dog. It's better to bring along a little extra than not enough. You might also want to pack a few doggy treats and search for a shaded area to take your breaks. Be sure to stay on the marked trail. In all county parks, dogs are required to be kept on a leash no longer than 6 feet in length at all times. A leash prevents dogs from becoming lost and also helps protect them from having an unexpected encounter with a rattlesnake, mountain lion, a sick or injured animal. Make sure to maintain control of your dog at all times. Dogs that are out of control or that pose a demonstrated risk to others may be asked to leave by a park ranger. Always clean up after your dog to allow everyone to enjoy our parks. If you decide to make it a weekend or an overnight in a county park with camping, the fee for dogs in camping parks is just $1 per dog per night. You will need to provide current license and vaccination information as well. Hiking with your dog in a county park is a great way to get some exercise and enjoy a change of pace from your usual walks around the neighborhood. So follow these tips, enjoy your hike, and get plenty of bonding time with your pup. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
The County of San Diego has temporarily shut down paid military-style firearms training at Covert Canyon and Alpine because the owner apparently missed a January 25th deadline for brush removal to prevent fires and obtain required permits, the San Diego Union-Tribune reports. The article indicates owner Mark Halcon must close commercial operations for now, including paid training of military and governmental security forces, but can continue to have recreational shooting at the site. Halcon also failed to apply for a grading permit for existing and proposed work, according to the county, and he did not make improvements at High Glen Road or complete brush removal, also failing to retrofit a building with sprinklers and other fire prevention materials. These requirements were all part of an October 27th agreement for the 160-acre site, which is surrounded by Cleveland National Forest. Halcon will have to pay $7,000 in previously suspended fees and make a $5,000 deposit to the county to continue processing site plans. We called Halcon for comment and did not receive a response. However, his attorney, Michael Anderson, told the UT that Halcon is bending over backwards to resolve these matters along with his consultants and engineers. Marco Gonzalez, an attorney representing neighbors Clark and Robin Williams, has said the latest actions by Halcon are, quote, consistent with the lack of respect that the applicant has shown over the years. The facility has previously been found to do grading without a permit and was shut down once in the past. Gonzalez's clients have filed suit against Halcon, citing violations of the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, and they have complained of excessive noise. Gonzalez told East County Magazine, there has been a slight decrease in activity at Covert Canyon since the cease and desist order was issued, though recreational shooting persists. He added that the CEQA litigation is moving forward and that he remains confident that the order allowing the activities at Covert Canyon will ultimately be overturned.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.